want to talk about several things. It should take probably an hour. It could be an hour and a half. If you have questions, ask them. Okay, I mean, just probably put up your hand so I see you, but you're welcome to interrupt. I don't want to pass something by and then leave you mystified because I missed it. So, you know, if you know something's missing in there, say something about it, all right? So it'll be an hour to an hour and a half, I think, depending on the questions and that kind of thing. Can you hear me, Mara? That's okay? Okay. The first thing I want to talk about is, one of the last things I'm going to talk about is why study soils? What do we get out of them? So I kind of want to wind up on that. It's a very important study, and I think you'll see some of the reasons as I talk. But the first thing I want to talk about is something that several of us have been emailing about recently, and that's the differences between soils and sediments. Okay, at the very most basic level, a soil is a sediment or can be considered a sediment because it's a fine weathered particle. Okay, it's not bedrock, in other words. But soils are a unique sediment. They are unlike any other sediment. So I really hope people will start referring to soils when they see them in the field as soils. There's still a tendency to lump everything. And the thing is that what you're describing when you do the soil descriptions is by definition a soil, because you're describing soil characteristics, not sediment characteristics. So if you think you see a soil, and I'm going to tell you how to recognize it, okay? If you think you've got a soil, it has different things to say about a site and about the occupants of that site and how they interacted with their environment than do sediments. If a site is in sediments, that's a totally different thing. There isn't the same kind of management of the landscape that there is if you have good, stable soils. So to begin with, there are three major and very interlinked differences between the two. One is that sediments move laterally across the landscape and often very great distances across the landscape. They erode in one place, they are transported by streams, gravity, wind, whatever, humans, and then they are redeposited at a new location. Soils do not move more than a few millimeters, laterally. Soils can move up and down. There's a kind of soil that definitely moves up and down seasonally with water and dryness and cold and heat. But soils don't move laterally more than just the tiniest fraction. They are in situ. They are staying in place. They represent a stable environment because they're allowed to stay in place, an environment that lets them stay in place, and I'll explain. Sediments represent an unstable environment, one that results in erosion, like over cultivation fields, that kind of thing, so that the topsoil erodes away and comes down slope and travels across country and is redeposited near your site, maybe. It's unstable. A lot's going on. It's a dynamic regime. Soil formation is pretty much the opposite. To have a soil weather to a soil, to have a sediment weather to a soil, it's got to stay in place for a long time. It's going to weather more chemically than physically, although both do both chemical and physical weathering. Sediments tend to weather physically. They roll around in stream beds. They bounce on stream beds. They roll down slopes. They get etched surfaces from wind, from blowing. Soils can weather more chemically, so that you can't see the surfaces anymore. The surfaces have been leached and chemically obscured, and the particles are extremely fine. So to get to that state, that originally sediment has to stay in place a long time, not be disturbed, have materials added to it, such as organic matter primarily. It'll be disturbed by bugs. It'll be disturbed by rainwater. Lots of little pores will enter the soil, and it will weather chemically so that you really can't see the surface characteristics that you would have when it was a sediment. Okay, and the third thing, and this is one that's very useful in the field. Soils support vegetation. Sediments do not. Soils support vegetation because they're stable, because they have organic matter, because they are aerated. They have more pores, well, often more pores than sediments. Sediments tend to be uniformly distributed. Soils will have little pockets, and there'll be, oh, rough surfaces, and there are places for roots to grab, that kind of thing. So when you see a root zone in the field, in a profile, in a sequence, a soil profile, you've got a soil. Whether it's a current root zone or an old root zone does not matter. When that root zone formed, that surrounding matrix was a soil. That can be incredibly important to know. And I think I will show you, not perhaps now, but a little later, a couple of slides of buried A-horizon soils, where pretty much what you see is the root zone. But there's a whole lot of important information to be gotten from them, like former forests where none exist now, that kind of thing. So it's quite an important characteristic. So those are the major three distinctions. Sediments move laterally, sediments represent develop in an unstable environment, and sediments do not support vegetation. Soils stay put, soils weather more chemically than physically, but both, and especially in the humid tropics, they weather very chemically. And they stay in place, they develop all kinds of characteristics that then support vegetation. They become relatively fertile. Sediments are not. Okay. Questions at this point, or shall I move right along? Okay. I'm going to talk about the horizons and about depositional units. Horizons are soils, soil horizons, and you'll see the usual ones are A, B, C, and there's an R for rock, which to a sedimentologist would not be considered a soil, but it is by pedologists. Okay, so the R horizon is fairly obvious. It's bedrock or the sediment on which the soil forms. The A is the maximum humic matter in the profile in that particular sequence. The A has the most organic matter of any horizon in the sequence. The B, well, I'm going to get to the C first. The C is the very earliest stage in soil formation, the very earliest. On top of the C, then the A forms with the humic matter that comes down, the bug poop and the leaves and all the rest of it. Then the B develops between them eventually in some profiles. It is the least fertile, most mature, most here, aluminum and iron rich. Oh, bless you, thank you. Thanks very much, sir. Hold on, a drink. Oh, I can get it. Sorry to those listening. Okay, the B horizon doesn't even always form. Many, many soil profiles here, but certainly in temperate areas, do not develop much of a B horizon. B horizon represents very long-term weathering. Okay. We also look at, and we describe a soil, and we often interpret it its horizon in the lab, by the way, or in the office. You don't do that necessarily in the field. In the field, you're going to describe, and you want to make sure you describe everything that you're going to need to figure it out. Is that Rona? No, oh, let's do more though, that's good. You want to make sure that you record everything that you're going to need later to determine the horizon. But we also interpret, or I do, depositional units. When you do the soil description for a report, what I do is I have a horizon, soil horizon and a sedimentary depositional unit. And that's standard. The USDA, Department of Ag, Soil Survey staff do the same thing. So the depositional unit may have several soil horizons in it. I need a blackboard. Anyway, that's okay. You can have a sediment come in, a sediment's deposited, and it forms soils. So you've got an A and a C horizon in that sediment. Then later, another sediment is transported down and redeposited over that original sediment, now soils, okay? The old one now is a buried sequence, right? It's a buried AC sequence. The current sequence is a separate depositional unit. Now you have two depositional units, okay? Each based on the sediment. The sedimentary event, okay? Bedrock, soils forming on bedrock, that forms a so-called depositional unit, although bedrock isn't deposited. So basically you're separating sedimentary events when you look at depositional units. The reason this is important is that they're trying to figure out what's happened around a site. And that site may have, if you've got a site on this earlier sequence, it's associated with one of the horizons in the earlier sequence. It may have been a stable environment for some time, but something happened, and that was buried. Excuse me. That was buried later by this other sediment that then formed soils, right? So it's important to distinguish one from the other, because one may be site-associated, the other may be quite recent. You may have multiple events, sedimentary events, and you often do, especially in sandy areas. It gets quite complex. So, okay, let me think. What happens initially as a soil form, I'm gonna, as I say, soil can form on a sediment or bedrock. It's sometimes easier to picture the bedrock. So let's start with bedrock. We've got basalt bedrock. There's no soil. Just in the same way that volcanic glass gets an oxidation rind or hydration rind, that rock's gonna get a rind too. I mean, you've seen weathered basalt with sort of a soft cortex. That's gonna turn into a soil eventually over time if it's allowed, right? If nothing moves it and rolls it down slope. And, well, we're talking about bedrock, never mind. It's not gonna roll down slope. Okay. What happens first, and I'm still not completely sure which forms first, the A or the C, because they really form together, but the C horizon is this initial rind, this softening. It's really not much of a soil, but you could get something to grow in it. You could get some little moss or something to grow in it. The A is forming almost simultaneously, and most of the time it is simultaneous, from things that fall on the bedrock, from the air, the bugs, the grass blades, the leaves, the animal poop, all these things. They're coming down from up, from the air and from the rest of the land, while the sea horizon is weathering down into the rock, sort of from below. The sea gets thicker, and the A gets thicker. And then over time, again, as I say, not in all sequences, in between, you may get a B horizon developing. And a B horizon, especially in lateritic soils like ours here, for instance, over on the Pali, if you look at those red soils, or orange anyway, a B horizon and a C horizon can be extremely difficult to distinguish. There are certain tricks, and that's about what you use, because the B horizon develops from the C and the A, but it shows more of the characteristics of the C. It's gonna look bright, oxidized. It's very not likely to look very dark and organic the way a lot of A horizon topsoils do. Okay, that's an oversimplification, because not all A's are dark, but the topsoil tends to be dark. Okay. The B horizon is gonna look like the C. There are differences. The C horizon will support, they'll all support vegetation, but the B is less likely to, because it's basically, well, it's infertile. It's almost, you'd almost say exhausted, except that's not a term we apply to the B. It's full of aluminum, full of iron, but it has virtually no nutrients, okay? It has good, strong structure. And this is an important point. Soil structure that's good and strong and well-developed has nothing to do with good, strong fertility. It's the opposite, in fact, in most cases. The B horizon can develop structures, in really amazing structures, including columns and prisms and even laminar, not laminar, that's a sedimentary term, but platy soil structure. Soil structure it describes a clump of soil, a ped of soil. Clady soil structure is entirely different from sedimentary laminae or beds. But I have many times seen a sedimentary bed described as clady soil structure, okay? You're gonna get clady soil structure as the result of chemical weathering. It has nothing to do with the deposition in a bed at all. It has to do with how those soil particles are being held together by colloidal clays, and it's the clump of the soil that you're describing. Is that, it's difficult to see the difference until you really see it in the field. And I mean, if you see sand that's come down in a bed, that's gonna be a sediment bed. Other sediment structures include rippling on dunes, cross bedding, all kinds of things. But they have nothing to do with the particles in a piece of the sediment clinging together. Nothing to do with that. In fact, they'll fall apart. The sedimentary bed will fall apart when you pull it out of the profile. The soil bed will not fall apart. It'll come out because it's chemically weathered and those particles are being held tight together, okay? So back to the B horizon, it will have strong structure and often quite unusual structures, angular beds, which is a stronger type of shape than subangular and rounded. It's easier to get a rounded edge. Yeah. Oh, good. Excuse me. Okay, we've got newcomers. Hi. No, that's all right. Give me a chance to cough. Hi. Okay. Thanks. Sorry. Where was I? Soil structure, but there was a point. Oh dear, I really have lost it. I'm not as sharp as I sometimes am. Being sick for 3 weeks really takes it out of you, I'm afraid. So soil structure has weathered chemically, just in the way that we've been talking about soils weathering chemically. So the clump, the ped of soil will hold together. Oh, okay, that's it. Angular soil structures represent more advanced weathering and more clay, usually clay-sized particles, and I'll explain that in a minute, than rounded or sub-rounded, subangular, that kind of thing. It's easier to form a ped with rounded sorts of corners and sort of rough edges than it is to get something that keeps a tight corner, right? So the B horizon, again, is going to have this often amazing soil structure, but it is very infertile in terms of plants. And the two are related. I mean, the reason it's infertile is what's gone into forming that structure. So you've got, okay, we've gone slightly. Are there questions? Am I being clear at all? I'm not really quite sure. I hope I am. If I'm not, say something, because I can go through it and make it clearer, I think. The soil characteristics we're describing for soils include what we just said, soil structure. They also include soil texture. And soil texture is our type of sedimentary size, but in sedimentology, what you do is particle size analysis. It's very precise. You get exact figures. You know exactly how many coarse grains of sand, fine grains of sand, silts, clays. The sizes of particles beginning at the top are boulder, cobble, pebble or gravel, granule, if you want to use that system. The systems vary, but anyway, boulder, cobble, pebble, granule, then sand in various sizes, silts and clays at the bottom, okay? These B horizons have lots of clay usually, lots of clay-sized particles. Clay-sized particles, and I'm not talking about the chemical clay, but the kind of particle, the size, excuse me. Clay-sized particles, unlike silts and sands, are platy. They cling together. And that's why you get this strong soil structure when you've got a lot of clay-sized particles. They're flat, and they bond to each other. Silts and sands tend to be roundish, and they roll around, and they don't bond the same way. So those are the particle sizes. As I say, in sedimentology, you do a thorough in lab, precise, accurate analysis of all the grain sizes you have, from boulder down to finest clay. Our equivalent, it's not an equivalent, but what we use in the field and what soil scientists use in the field, and it's perfectly adequate for almost all cases, certainly for archaeology it is soil texture, which is not precise. It's not, you're not going to get it down to milligrams or anything like that, and you don't want to. That's not the purpose. What it does is it, this is the textural triangle, and I'm not going to go through it right now because it takes a little time to get used to, but you should all familiarize yourselves with this. And by the way, the Soil Survey Manual, which has all these things, is on the web, right? It's the U.S. Department of Agriculture Soil Survey Staff Soil Survey Manual, 1993, I think, is the latest. So you can get explanations. It takes too much time to go through in this little short introduction, but the triangle has boxes that have amounts of percentages silt, percentages clay, percentages sand. What you're going to do is you're going to look at what you have in your hand, and I think the easiest thing to determine first is how much sand is in it, because sand is gritty. You can feel it. Okay. So you determine that, figure out the percentage, say 40%. Then what you have left is silt and clay. For those, you're going to, before you do the soil texture, before you analyze it, you're going to have to do some tests on soil consistence. And let's just talk about that while we're at it. Even though soil texture is, I think, the second thing after the color that you record in a description, it's the last thing you're going to interpret. Okay. For soil consistence, meaning, hold on, let me open to it. Anyway, stickiness and plasticity, dry consistence, moist consistence, stickiness and plasticity. Okay, you're going to hold a pit, you're going to break it. If it breaks with ease with a thumb and one finger, it's going to be one type of consistence, either dry or moist, depending on the state of the soil. All right, you don't need to do both dry and moist. If the soil is moist, do that one. Then stickiness and plasticity are quite important. They will distinguish between clays and silts as a rule. And those are difficult to distinguish by just feel. They both feel silky. Clays are a bit slicker, but they're very fine. They're not gritty. You're not going to know for sure which is what. So you make a wire, and the instructions actually are in this little handout that everybody has seen before. We've used it at the museum. We've used it at Ogden, we used it at Erie, so it's around, and I'm sure Wendy probably has it too somewhere, yeah. You make a wire, you drop water on the pit, not too much water, or you get a slurry and start over, and that is common. You drop water on the pit till it's actually wet, not just moist, but wet, but not saturated, not falling apart. Roll a wire, okay? See how fine the wire is. And the instructions are in the little handout and in the soil survey manual. You'll define it in one way or another. You'll also test that wire or the ped for stickiness. Does it come off both the thumb and the forefinger cleanly? Does it come off the thumb but not the forefinger cleanly? I mean, it's tedious detail perhaps, but you come out with something. You come out knowing pretty firmly roughly the percentage of silt and clay you've got. So then you go back to your soil textural triangle and feed in what you think you have in terms of silt, which is maybe 30%, and clay, which is maybe 30%, and I think that adds up to 100. You should add up to 100 at the end, all right? You're not going to be exact. You're not going to be perfect. And one person may interpret finds more often as silt than another person who interprets them as clays. But in your own work, there's going to be a consistency. And you can certainly see relative clayiness and siltiness in these things. Silts, incidentally, are very interesting. There used to be, and I hope is not anymore, a terrible bunch of flyers that went around from some company in the Midwest that talked about determining soil texture. But their idea was that, well, you just don't even consider silt. it just doesn't exist somehow. You look for the sand and you look for the clay and poor old silt just goes walking. Well, you can't do that because in archaeology, a lot of our deposits are silts, okay? And we don't want to anyway. So you want to consider all three. You don't want just to dismiss one out of hand and ignore it. It has important things to say. Silts are often fertile. Silts support plants. I mean, you know, with the addition of organic matter, da-da-da, but a silt size is a good size for a lot of gardens. It's often the size you find at an archaeological site. Charcoal, ash, well, especially ash, rather, tends to be silt-sized. So you've got a lot of reasons to look at silt. And silt is neat. It's an interesting thing. Okay, we've said sand is gritty, you know that. And there are charts that are little figures that can show you the size sand you're working with somewhere. Well, that's a nice photocopy, but anyway, you can compare what you have with this, and you'll determine whether you have very coarse sand, fine sand, da-da-da. Clays are sticky. They're plastic. Okay, if you get a high plasticity with the fine wire forming when you test your wet soil, it's going to be full of clay. It'll probably also have silt in it. But clay, again, clay particles are platy shaped. They cling together. They give good, strong structure. And that's what the wire's all about. They're holding together. Silts, if you have a silt in your hand and it's dry, absolutely dry, and you blow on it, it goes up like talcum powder. And that's a distinguishing characteristic of silt. And I've done it many times. Clay won't do it. It'll just lie there looking at you. Sand won't do it. Well, very fine sand might, but you know it's sand because it's gritty. So silt will blow up like talcum powder, okay? Wet silt's even more interesting. And I didn't know what it was like until one day I was wandering through a loess system in Monowili. And it had been raining, and the soil was pretty saturated. And it's a former loess site, a terrace site. So we're just padding along through the mud, and I noticed suddenly that not only am I sinking very slightly, but the stuff is puffy. It's coming up around my boots. It's like, like that. Like, clays don't do that. You slip and fall in clay, but it doesn't puff up around your boots. So that's the wet equivalent of the dry talcum powder. So silts can be recognized, but they are tricky. Okay. And as I say, a lot of archaeological material is silt size, so we do need to look at all three of them. They have different things to say. Clay offers properties that help, for instance, in retaining soils, because they hold together. So that's a good thing. But silt also offers a crop holes, sort of pores to grab root in. It's aerated a little better. It doesn't stick together so firmly that a root can't get a chance, can't get a grip. Sand is great for drainage for crops, and I'm talking a lot about crops, but I mean, there are other purposes too, of course. But sand is good for crops, but you can't have only sand because all the moisture, rainwater and so forth will just pass right through. You want clay to hold the rainwater, but you want silt to let some through and hold the rest. So silt's a nice sort of happy medium. Okay. Excuse me. There are special horizon designations that you'll come across. They tend to be subscripts and are we'll call it that. AN is one, and it means anthropic. A small AN after a C, after an A horizon, for instance, means it's a cultural. It means actually that it's a plowed. It was originally a plowed A horizon soil. But I do extend that to mean cultural, because there is no real subscript for cultural, or no suffix, I should say, for cultural, other than AN, and anthropic does mean human associated. So. B is buried. If you have a multi-depositional unit situation like the one I described a little while ago, where you've got a sediment burying another sediment that's turned into soil horizons, the lower of the two is not only the second depositional unit, but it's also buried. So it's sort of a duplication of terminology. The B after a B or horizon or an A horizon or a C horizon simply means it's not the current soil. It's not active. It's buried beneath something else. And the depositional units from two on up also mean that same thing. Okay. G for glay. Glaying, and you do see at least partial glaying here quite a bit in especially terrace systems, irrigated terrace systems. The usual cause is saturation here, but what glaying is the result of soil formation in an a reducing environment. No free oxygen or minimal free oxygen. You've got hydrodynes, but not oxygen. So the color of the oxidized soil, which let's say is red, is yellow red, will become more a gray, or in some cases it's quite beautiful. It can become green, it can become blue. It depends on the chemicals in the soil that are in the soil that's formed. But glaying does often represent saturation. However, it does not always represent agricultural irrigation. And that gets tricky in some of these field sites because they are built from streams, right? They use streams. Well, streams also saturate soils. So it's important to look at the glaying that you've got if you're in an agricultural situation and really think about whether it is a former field that's glayed because of irrigation or whether it might be a current glaying situation from the stream. Okay. They're all just things you think about, and you don't have the answers when you go back to the office, but you often do later if you've got enough information recorded. And that's why this soil description is rather tedious. You just have to make sure you've got full information, because leaving out one little thing can mean that you'll misinterpret what's going on around that site completely. Okay, let's see what I've got here. This, I hope, doesn't need saying, but I think I better say it because I have run across a problem many times, both here and in Guam and in Asia. In this country, in the US anyway, we number strata, we number layers. I'm not talking about horizons or sedimentary units or anything, just layers from the top down, one on up. I mean, this being X, the bottom layer being 9 or whatever you've got. Okay, and believe it or not, they do it differently in some areas of the world, but I assume they assign those numbers after they get back to the lab, because how do you know how many layers you're gonna get? So we do 1 on down to 10 or 20 or whatever. If you have, and this is where I really need the blackboard, I should have mentioned that. If you have a stratified site, or you've got a soil sequence, you've got a layer 1, a layer 2, a layer 3, a layer 4, and this layer down here looks just exactly like layer 1. It is not layer 1. It is layer 5. Okay? And I know this may sound really remedial, but I have seen so many professional archaeologists, including some with advanced degrees, do the other thing. Our layers as archaeologists are based on nothing more, nothing less than the law of superposition, stratification. They're not based on genetic resemblance or anything else. If the layer is in 10th position, it's layer 10. It'd be great to say in your notes, looks exactly like layer 1. I mean, that's cool, but don't call it layer 1, because that just confuses everything, including the person back in the office who tries to figure out what it was you had. It can be very difficult. Oh, is this? There they are. These are the two we've been. They were in the field today, so so they're late. Hi, Ron. No, that's okay. I'll run through the very opening part with Tom sometime before he takes off for Guam, okay? Because, you know, it's that very beginning basic bit. You've heard it, so. Hi, this is Tom Leppard, everybody. He's EREE's new Guam manager. So anyway, Tom, I was just saying, I'll run through the very beginning bit with you sometime at work, okay? Because it's kind of basic, and I knew you were going to miss it, going to be late. Okay, so stratigraphy, again, is based on the law of superposition, and it's one on down. And it doesn't matter what this lower one looks like, it's still going to be the lowest number, right? It's very important to do that because archaeology is all about deposition. It's all about depositional agents regimes, modes, when something arrived, how it arrived. It's all about what buried what, and when this site was inhabited, and what's gone on since that site was abandoned, that kind of thing. So we have to look at stratigraphy first and foremost. It is really important to recognize similarities between, say, layer 1 and layer 5, because you may have a repetition of a sequence, which is very interesting. You could have some cultural or other influence that is recreating a sequence you had once before, that kind of thing. For some reason, similar soils are coming in at two very different points in time. Okay. If you got questions, thoughts, if you want to throw a soil pet at me, this is the time. I'm just checking on. Okay. Oh yeah, this is just a small point, but I said I'm going to wind up talking about why we're looking at the soils. I hope I've made a case for that to some degree so far. But this point came up. Tim Reith and I both used to teach this course out at ERE, and we discovered one day that we approach soil interpretation from two different angles, and it was kind of interesting because they're both very important, but we see it slightly differently. He is interested in the sediments and soils in a sequence as evidence for what went on after a site was abandoned, post-depositional processes. Absolutely valid and very good. And I realized that I look at it as what was going on when the site was occupied, like how were the people interacting with their environment. So they're both very important, but they're different ways to look at it. And you do need to think about both, because you'll get both kinds of information from good soils analysis and good sedimentary analysis. And by the way, if you do have sediments, yeah, do describe them. You won't describe them in terms of soil description, soil characteristics, but make a note, you know, add a note or something. Layer 3 also has a bed of fine ash, volcanic ash. That's a sediment. You want to mention that. Or has a bed of fine sand. Whenever you can, get the fullest information you can. Again, that's the point. A couple more things, and then that's really just about, I've covered the basics that I wanted to cover. There's tons of more. I mean, this should be a semester-long course. But I mean, I'm just trying to get you sort of thinking about why we're doing it. And I know that people have asked me that many times. Why are we even bothering? Well, because soils do tell you about management of environments, soils associated with a site, archaeological soils. Pat Kirch and I had that dialogue, email dialogue about whether archaeological things were soils or sediments. He maintained absolutely adamantly, till the end, and he got tired, that they are sediments. My position is that, yes, indeed, they are sediments to begin with, absolutely. But if they stay in place, and they weather, and they support vegetation, perhaps, roots, and they get more and more organic matter, and they're stable, they're soils. They develop into soils. He's interested in archaeological deposition. I mean, I understand where he's coming from, I think. I mean, how did the site get there? Yeah, but you also have to think about what happens after the site is there. Cultural management of the environment will yield soils, building retaining walls, building berms, irrigating, awai, whatever. It will retain the original sediments, and eventually they'll turn into soils if they last long enough and don't erode out. Humans have a tendency, when they move into an area, to stabilize the environment initially. I mean, through time, I don't mean the first day, but by doing this, by building walls and berms and all the rest of it, and by dropping charcoal and ash and debris and midden, you do stabilize the surface. I mean, you're packing things together. You know, foot traffic, too. So initially, humans tend to stabilize the environment. But, what happens over time is that humans overuse the environment. They give their fields too short, fallow seasons. The soils don't have a chance to recover, and I do want to talk about lateritic soils in the tropics for a minute. And eventually what happens is the soils erode away and become sediments again. And they're transported somewhere else and redeposited, and then through time, maybe they'll turn into soils again. Okay? What happens, excuse me, in the humid tropics particularly, our soils are fragile in terms of nutrients, in terms of structure even. The basaltic soils, the brightly colored soils. The nutritional system in lateritic soils in the tropics is entirely in the plant itself. The plants, roots, leaves, stem, and roots. If you lop off the head of that plant in lateritic soils in the tropics, you've killed not only the plant, you've destroyed the soil because it's just going to erode away. There's nothing to retain. I mean, if you have walls and so forth, it'll stay for a while. But cutting off that nutritional system also cuts off what was retaining the soil, because the plants retain the soil too. And eventually, that soil is likely to erode away, da-da-da, and so forth, and once again become a sediment. So humans have both kinds of effects. And when you look at a site in the field in a sequence, you really need to look at what's around it, what's over it, what's under it, over the cultural layer, what the cultural layer itself looks like, boundary characteristics, wavy boundaries, lower boundaries on horizons. If they're wavy, they suggest disturbance, plowing, truncation. So if you've got a wavy lower boundary, that suggests that there may have been something going on. If you have a nice smooth boundary, especially if it's a very leached boundary, if the boundary itself is quite thick, and I don't mean the horizon, that's another confusion that's common, the lower boundary of that horizon, if it's quite thick and leached, then it's quite stable. It's been stable for a long time, chances are. A broken boundary is sort of obvious. It's just obviously disturbed. I mean, you've got pits or something like that, okay? But the wavy and smooth tell you different things about a soil around a site. So you want to look at everything you're seeing, and root zones especially, and pores. Everything you see not only in this cultural site deposit, but in the deposits below it and above it. Because the ones below it may have affected what happened to the archaeological layer. The ones above it have resulted maybe from what the humans did with their environment, or what the environment did to the humans. So what you're looking at is human environmental interaction. And sediments and soils do tell you several quite different things about it. The other reason we look at soils, as I have said very often to monitors who were bored out of their gourds because they hadn't seen anything cultural in about 2 weeks, you've always got soils. Look at the soils and the sediments. You can learn a heck of a lot about old land, old surfaces. I mean, out at Mololani, where we've monitored for 4 years, I mean, they applied fills that absolutely formed level surfaces where the slope had gone like this. You know, you can get that kind of information out of soils and sediments. It's really quite fascinating. We got some pretty interesting information just from looking at soils. Anyway, I do want to show you my two slides. Thank you, Mara. Thanks. It's that one's the first one, speaking of Mololani. Oh, maybe it's not there. There it comes. Okay, this is one of the Mololani trenches, and it's quite deep. There's no scale, but that's at least 5 meters deep. We had thought going into, Mololani's out at the Marine Base on Mokapu Peninsula, for those of you who don't know, and we were monitoring during housing construction. We at one point during the project thought we would not find any A horizons at all. any A horizon, at least topsoils, and probably any A horizons. Because back in the 60s when we were all marching, when this place was being totally destroyed, they just graded madly, and then they dumped a whole lot of fill, all right, to make a new surface that could support housing at that time, that stage in the housing. So this was kind of interesting because, yeah, it's true, I don't think we ever did get a topsoil, the most fertile A horizon, but you've also got a subsoil that's an A horizon. There's a lower part of the A horizon that forms under the topsoil. The topsoil's exposed and it's getting the leaves and the bugs and all the rest, getting those deposited into it, but the subsoil develops with the topsoil, and we have a subsoil here. We did have, in fact, an A horizon subsoil. This upper stuff is fill, okay, but this, you see, well, you can see it's slightly darker for one thing. It's also different structurally from this, and the only way you can tell that in this slide is because of the way it photographs. This looks flat, this doesn't, okay. So the soil structure is going to be different. So the reason this is important is that cultural materials are usually associated with A horizons, right? Buried A's, current A's, whatever. They aren't necessarily all with topsoils. They may even be in the subsoil. We did not find anything cultural in that subsoil. But you certainly could. So if you've got any form of A horizon that's buried, well, or current, I mean, you have real possibilities for cultural material. Let's go to the next one. Let me think. Yeah, this one. Okay, this one. Yeah, thanks. I should have shrunk that a bit, but that's okay. This is actually a Thai site where I've been doing soils. And I wanted to show you this because of the buried A horizons, too. There's a current A. This is on a stream terrace, granitic sand, very high. And there are village plants up on top, but certainly no forest, nothing like that. The first buried A is here, the second buried A is here, and it's this one that was very interesting to us because not only is it an A horizon, which means in this case it was a topsoil probably, that there was a surface at that time, but it's got oxidized mottles coming into an otherwise glade layer. Well, the oxidized mottles, and I'm sorry, I should have shrunk it more so you could see more of them. They go on down. They're trees, or rather, probably shrubs, bushes. So there was good evidence for a former open kind of maybe a scrub forest, something like that, where none exists today. That was the first time we had realized that there had been different vegetation cover at one time. This, again, is... No, it's just organic, it's not glade, but the oxidized models follow roots. Oxidized models can follow roots, they can follow rocks, they can be the remnant of rock that's softened. Models are interesting and they're quite important to look at as well. Excuse me. I think that's probably as much as I'm going to go into now, because the rest is testing everything and looking at the characteristics, and that's another subject. I mean, that's another evening, I think. Do you have questions or anything? Yeah, Tom.
Thank you very much. I haven't listened to you talk about soil for many years.
Takes you back, don't it? Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad.
But I was really hoping that you could, and if you have the energy.
Yes. It's lowy.
I think of very lowy on the river side of the stream.
Yeah.
And that was, at the time, I thought that was one of the most incredible archaeological expeditions I've ever seen.
Those projects were incredible. They were incredible. I mean, those sites were incredible. This is Upland Kane Ohe primarily, but also Mauna Wili had some pretty nice stuff later. But I think you mean Luluku, the Upland Kane Ohe. It was the H3 project. But, okay. we had hectares of old loess. We really did. And we were lucky because in many cases, okay, for one thing, we did trenches. I believe in trenches in ag areas. Anything that opens a long exposure, especially one that goes from this terrace down to this terrace, okay? You want to cross-cut the facings as much as you can, not for the soil information, but just to correlate the soils on the two terraces, okay? So because we were able to use those long trenches, and we had a lot of them, we were able to see buried facings as well as buried soils. So that sort of firmed up. It made me more confident that what I was describing as a former loess soil was, in fact, a former loess soil, and not just some saturated soil for another reason. Loess soil, well, I'm going to talk about buried loess soil, right, mainly. There are shades of irrigation, certainly. Many, it's a continuum. It's not an absolute. There is seasonal irrigation. There's of course, dry land, unirrigated cultivation. And that's very common and we saw a lot of that in Luluku and in Mauna Willi too. That can also be terraced, although the terraces aren't usually as level or as expanse, as huge, as large as they are for loess systems. When you come down on a soil beneath the current sequence, a buried soil, that looks humic, organic, somewhat. It won't be very organic at this stage if it's been there a long time. Whereas the overlying soils are not very organic, okay? Something made that soil organic. You want to think about a buried loess soil. You want to think about a buried, at least cultivated soil. Glaying does certainly come up, and we certainly had glayed loess soils, buried loess soils, okay, in Luluku. Again, as I said earlier, you have to make sure that you're not just getting glaying from the current stream, but you can tell. I mean, you know where the stream is, you know what your depths are, you know what groundwater's coming in and so forth. So you're looking at organic content, you're looking at glaying, you're also looking, and this is where I haven't convinced some colleagues at all, but you also get dispersed charcoal in old loess soils. Some folks think that you just can't, you shouldn't date, and nobody here, by the way, but I've had the argument many times, that you just can't date agricultural charcoal because it all came in from heaven. I'm sorry, that it all came in from upslope, all right? My position on that is, if it's a well-maintained loess set, it didn't. It's not going to travel more than maybe one terrace, if that. It's also going to be dispersed charcoal. It's not going to be big pieces of charcoal, which you do get in dry land ag, and which we actually date a lot. It's somehow irrigated field charcoal that bothers people because they see it really traveling. But I think maybe that's because they haven't worked in these loess sets, which were so maintained and so managed and so controlled. I truly don't think that a charcoal in this buried terrace came from any farther away originally than the next terrace up. And that, frankly, I think it started right where it is, because you do mix charcoal into soils that are going to support taro, kala, or whatever crop, into an irrigated field soil. You want fertilization, and charcoal offers it. You're going to mix in other things. You're also in dryland soils. You know that you dibble, right? You'll cultivate with a digging dibble stick. So in irrigated systems, I'm not used to thinking of that, but the people certainly did mash the soil around, sort of loamy loamy it, I guess. They may have used dibble sticks. I'm not sure, but in any case, you move it around, you mess it around. It's not going to look absolutely dead homogeneous. You're going to see signs of changed color, changed just little bits of variation, mottling perhaps sometimes. If you get something that brings oxygen down into a glade soil, again, you can get this mottling. You're not going to have a lot of rock in a loess soil. In a dryland soil, yeah, you might have lots of rock. And in the dryland situation, the soil will not be glayed. But as I say, there are in-betweens, and there is a seasonal irrigation system that I think I saw in Mount Owelee repeatedly. And you do get some glaying in that, but it's a very, very light glaying. It's not classic. So you're looking at a whole bunch of characteristics, I guess is all I can say. Is there something in particular that I should be addressing? Is that all right? Okay. The best situation is when you hit that buried terrace facing too. It's the cheat sheet. Yeah, like, hey you, I'm a buried terrace. So that was cool. And in one case of Mount Owelee, we actually hit three facing segments like this. I mean, two buried, one more current like this. Nice. Nice stuff. Beautiful, beautiful cultivation areas those still are. A lot of the sites are actually preserved. In Mount Owelee especially, they did a good job. So, anyway, thanks, Tom. Thanks. Anything? Nothing.
Have you read some reports that mention a bow layer or anything?
Yeah, thank you. See, that's the kind of thing I knew I was going to forget tonight. Okay, thank you very much. The O layer is on the surface. And it is not a soil, but it's what's going to become a soil. Because it's the decomposing leaves, it's the decomposing grass blades, it's all those things. And the poop, I keep saying, but it's true. I mean, that's part of what forms an A horizon. So an O horizon, when you go to describe it, it's the only horizon that you describe in terms of centimeters above surface. Okay, so +2 to 0 would be your O horizon. And then 0 to 25 could be your A, whatever. Thank you so much for asking about that. There was something else I missed completely, and I'm going to mention an E horizon. There's a very special kind of A. Okay, I've said that lateritic soils in the tropics tend to become exhausted easily, right? Well, there's another sign of soil exhaustion, and that's this kind of A horizon that used to be called, and is not any longer, I'm glad to say, an A2, which was very confusing because you number your A's and your C's, you know, and your B's according to the layer, like at B1, B2, B3, B4, A1, A2, A3, A4. No, A2 was a special thing. So now they've gotten back to calling it an E horizon, eluviated, meaning everything has left it, basically, right? Everything hasn't left it. Again, you do have the aluminum and the iron, the inorganics, but I bet you'll recognize it even if you've never seen an E horizon before, because suddenly you're faced with this bleached out, sickly looking soil. It really is. It looks kind of yellowish or something. Not even. It's kind of beigeish often. It just looks unhappy. Sorry. But it does. It wants some nutrition. It will not have good structure. It'll be soft. It just doesn't have much character and much soil characteristic left. So it'll develop when you overuse the A, and of course the C, the V, C, whatever's down there. But the A is what takes the brunt of overuse, right? Because that's what's going to, it eventually erodes away. And the A is where most of the vegetation is. So the E is going to develop probably below an A1, which will still be your topsoil. You'll still have a very thin topsoil, probably. And then you'll get this very unusual looking soil. So, and we get them here, for sure. Waimea-Kauai High, Luluku, you will see them. Wherever the fallow, the resting period for the soil, between cultivation periods, wherever that was too short, eventually the soil does become exhausted. And I think, but I'm not certain, that the E horizon is sort of an early stage in this total soil exhaustion that you get in the humid tropics, but you get E horizons in other places too. I mean, that's not just the humid tropics at all. So yeah, over farming, basically, that kind of thing. Okay, O-E. Anything else? I'm glad you asked about the O. Didn't mean to miss that. I think that's enough, isn't it? Thank you very much. don't know how to turn this off, do you?